The list of people fighting against texting while driving ranges from President Obama to Oprah. It's banned in 19 states and in Washington, D.C. Still, many people do it, as you can see on any highway this morning, no doubt. And Sasha Pfeiffer reports from member station WBUR.
It seems so obvious. You shouldn't be typing a text message if you're operating a moving vehicle.
I really shouldn't at all, but I do.
Todd Hudson is 34 years old, and he's sitting in a coffee shop in Somerville, Massachusetts, called the Diesel Cafe. He says he tries not to text while driving if he's in heavy traffic or taking turns. If he does do it, he likes to pull over to the side of the road first.
Yeah, that's my ideal, but I never quite match that ideal. I mean, you get a text from somebody and you want to respond to it.
He's not breaking the law. Massachusetts is poised to ban texting while driving, but hasn't done it yet. At a nearby table, Nick Gross, who's 46, says he used to text behind the wheel, but not anymore.
I couldn't do the two things at the same time without sacrificing one of them.
But he remembers the mental battle of being in his car and wanting to tap away on that little keypad.
My internal dialogue is to have to tell myself, I'm going to be there in 5 minutes. I'm going to see this person in 5 minutes anyway. There's no point in texting that. But, you know, on the flip side, it's like, well, I need to tell them I'm going to be there in 5 minutes so that they know and they can be waiting for me.
And remember, Nick is pushing 50. So texting while driving isn't something just teenagers and 20-somethings do. In fact, the biggest growth in texting is among people over 35. But even though some studies show texting while driving is more dangerous than drunk driving, not everyone thinks it's always unsafe.
There's certainly times when driving when I think you can do it and times when you can't.
Tyler Ostergaard is 25.
So if you're going through a rotary, yeah, then it's a bad idea. But I think that you can make a judgment call. There are times, if you're like going down the highway, for example, where you can fairly easily text and maintain good driving without endangering yourself or others.
He and other people I talk to say highways are straight and wide, so you can see what's coming and stop texting if things seem risky. Some people told me they won't text in intersections or bad weather, but will do it at stop signs and red lights. Others say they text when they're in the suburbs, but not in cities, because of all the bicyclists and pedestrians. Ben Voskarichian, who's 26, says he tries to spread the word that texting while driving is unsafe.
I always tell all my friends, I'm like, stop, get off your phone, like if I'm driving next to them, or if I'm a passenger or whatever.
Of course, he admits he occasionally texts behind the wheel himself.
That's kind of hypocritical. Not kind of, it is hypocritical. So.
But to borrow a phrase from a local performer, why settle for a single standard when you can have a double one? For NPR News, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Blanc. Now to a sweet tradition in this country for more than 80 years.
The cookies are here!
Madame.
Oh, the cookies are here.
Girl Scout cookies, of course. Those ad campaigns have evolved over the years. And now, in 2010, even bigger changes are transforming the $700 million a year business. This season, Girl Scouts are making their sales pitches online. A troop in the San Francisco suburb of Antioch let reporter Rachel Dornhelm tag along at a recent meeting.
Talk about enabling cookies online. Four girls are clustered around a laptop in troop leader Monique Lazzarini's kitchen. They're learning how to market their cookies with Evites on Facebook and with text messages.
Are we good? Are we missing anything? I think it looks good. Read it one more time.
I'm a Girl Scout in Troop 30313, and I was wondering if I could fax you an order form to purchase Girl Scout cookies.
Perfect.
Lazzarini's troop is taking advantage of the fact that for the first year, Girl Scouts is embracing online cookie marketing. 11-year-old Emily Costanza says she's enjoying the crash course in social media.
I feel that everyone should be using this resource. It's very helpful and it's a very well experience for younger children because they will know when they're older how to use it and just... It's a way to have fun with technology.
I love the fact that we're, you know, moving from door to door to online because it says we sort of are really in touch with girls today.
That's Girl Scouts of the USA Chief Marketing Officer Laurel Ritchie. She says whether the girls are going in person or marketing online, the important thing is they're coming up with a plan and executing it. It was a different story last year, though, when a young Girl Scout in North Carolina posted a simple video on YouTube to pitch her cookies.
Hi, I'm Wild Day Freeborn, and I'm
need you to buy some cookies.
The Girl Scouts called the video a violation of its rules, and the scuffle over the 8-year-old's viral effort became a national story. Richie says safety was the sticking point.
And we just took a moment to breathe and make sure we could find a way to meet their desire to market online with our desire to make sure that they do it in a way that is safe.
Richie says they worked with Microsoft and developed a safety program for their members. She says the new Girl Scout pledge about how to be careful online is just as important as teaching girls the technologies themselves. 10-year-old Scout Natalie Gutierrez ticks off some of the points.
Don't show your picture. Don't tell your last name. Don't tell where you live. They might come and find you, which is really bad. Don't tell them your phone number if they say, like, it's safe, I'm okay, I'm a doctor or something. They might be lying.
The kids are doing their work online, supervised by parents. Parents that are getting busier by the day and welcome technological help. That's according to Marina Park. She's CEO for the Girl Scouts of Northern California. Lately, she says it's been hard to find parents with the time to volunteer with the group, let alone do cookie sales.
And if the parents are working, you really don't want walking your kid, after dark when you've gotten home and there's homework to be done and dinner to be made and all of the things that need to happen, and weekends people are busy and the neighbors that you're going to try and place their orders aren't home. So I think it just simplifies the whole thing.
Still, even the troops like Lazzarini's, who've embraced the technology, can still do some door-to-door.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth, and I was wondering if you'd like to buy some Girl Scout cookies.
For NPR News, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
Now to another vision for Detroit. For $1, you can own a piece of the Motor City. It'll be a small piece, 1 square inch to be exact, but your investment in that micro plot of land also gives you passage into an online community that's coming up with bigger ideas for the city. Sarah Hewlett of Michigan Radio explains.
Jerry Pfaffendorf is not your typical real estate developer, but then the people lining up to buy into his project are not quite your typical investors.
Inchvestors, first off, we call them Inchvestors.
Pfaffendorf calls his project Loveland, and it's a hybrid, part virtual and part physical.
It's almost like what we want to do is we want to build this wild, you know, social network of people that's like literally built out of the dirt and like the ground.
This is the physical part, a vacant lot with a view of a burned out garage and several other empty parcels.
We are at the intersection of Verner Highway and Holcomb Street on the east side of Detroit. And we are walking over to the first property that I purchased with the Loveland Project.
Pfaffendorf bought this property at auction for $500. Then he put 10,000 square inches up for sale, and people from all over the planet began snapping them up. They've now all been sold to nearly 600 people. The deeds Pfaffendorf mails out are not legally valid, so the people who buy inches won't get to vote in Detroit or have to pay taxes. Some Inchvestors have sentimental ties to the city and just like the idea of having a physical stake in the place where they or their parents or grandparents grew up. But a lot of them are attracted by the project's virtual possibilities and say Loveland is sort of like the popular SimCity or Farmville online games, but with real land. Rita King is the biggest landholder in Loveland with 1,000 inches. She works for IBM, and she's an entrepreneur with a firm that helps companies use social media and virtual worlds. King is excited about the project's potential to help the real city in which Loveland sits.
Because Loveland is physically located in Detroit, it takes those 500 Inchvestors, and it ties us to Detroit, which means that the development of Detroit is now of critical importance to hundreds of people who don't live or work in Detroit. And now I, for one, am starting to look very, very closely at Detroit and how can I help Detroit level up along with Loveland in our small way.
Leveling up is a phrase from the world of video games. It's what happens when the character you're playing makes it to the next level in the game. And for many, it's an apt description of what Detroit needs to do. King says she expects the online component of Loveland to include interactive maps and stories. And proceeds from the project's next phase are expected to be used to fund grants for nonprofit groups around Detroit. But for all the excitement about the possibilities Loveland holds with high-minded techno-futurists, the project is also fodder for derision and mockery in some quarters. On an online discussion board called Detroit Yes, one commentator said it sounded like a pyramid scheme without the pyramid. Bill Johnson is one of those who's criticized the project. Sitting at a coffee house in front of his laptop, he says it smacks of exploitation.
You know, in places outside of Detroit, we got a bad reputation as a sort of pitiful, worthless place. And this guy's preying on that. That's what he's really peddling.
But Loveland creator Jerry Pappendorf says Detroit is a place of opportunity and creativity. And he shares an optimism about the city and his project with Ricky Collins. Collins is 9 years old and lives next door to the empty lot that Pappendorf bought. She lives in the only house left on this block.
I want people to, like, remember this place, remember it. And I want people to come over so we can get to know each other, learn the things about each other.
It's not clear how many of the people who've bought inches in Loveland will actually visit their tiny plots in person. But Rita King says she intends to make the trek from New York City. She also plans to install a mailbox so people can send things to and from the site. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Hewlett in Detroit.
We're listening to the top single being sold on the country's biggest music retailer, iTunes. It's Break Your Heart by Tayo Cruz. At 99 cents a pop, all those downloads mean a lot of money for iTunes, but the amount of music sold online is still smaller than the amount of music that is downloaded for free. The big music labels are still on the lookout for ways to entice fans into paying. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on a music streaming service that's popular in Europe and may be headed for the United States.
There's a lot of buzz these days about one service in particular. It's been a hit with more than 7 million fans overseas.
Spotify has just completely charmed Europe with its ability to deliver to you unlimited streaming of any song you've ever thought of in your life.
Ted Cohn used to work for EMI Records. He now runs a music consulting firm. Spotify subscribers can have access to more than 7 million songs from any internet-connected computer.
And it's a wonderful experience when you try and stump it, and everything you try and stump it with comes up.
And it's free if you're willing to listen to a few ads. Cohn says the record companies aren't anxious to let Spotify into the U.S.
The rights holders are all concerned that we went from selling a $10 CD to selling a 99-cent track, and now we're talking about to a quarter of a cent per stream played per user.
Spotify has been trying to get fans to pay 10 euros a month so they don't have to listen to any ads. That idea finally started to catch on after customers were able to get all 7 million songs on their smartphones. But even if Spotify doesn't take off in the U.S., the largest music retailer, Apple, may launch a similar service. It recently purchased the music streaming website Lala.com. But if it's any indication, subscription-based music streaming services like Rhapsody and Napster have been around for years, and they aren't that popular. It's a hard sell at the Student Union at San Francisco State University. Just ask 21-year-old Carlos Sicat.
I don't want to go through the process of, like, opening up my internet browser, actually finding the music, searching it. I could just go on my computer. It's much less of a hassle to do that.
21-year-old Greg Hardy says he doesn't even listen to all the songs he has on his iPod.
Most people I know don't listen to all 500 of those songs if they have it filled on. They might just cycle through 30 or 40 of them, or of the same songs.
And of course, many students get their music free from friends and illegal download sites. Still, analysts believe that Spotify could entice them because they can try it for free before they sign up. Bruce Houghton, who edits the music and technology blog Hypebot, says that's what's happened in Europe.
The average Spotify user, and this isn't a secret, has 15,000 tracks in their Spotify playlists or favorites. How many of us own 15,000 tracks? So the case with a lot of these services is simply getting people to try them, then the word spreads.
But it's not clear if the record companies will allow a free service when Spotify launches in the U.S. Still, at a time when record sales continue to drop, the major music labels may be ready to try anything. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
If your workplace is anything like ours, the Girl Scouts have already struck. Our first delivery of cookies arrived yesterday. And all throughout this building, people are noshing on pretty much every variety of Girl Scout cookie available. Now, as good as they are, some people aren't content to just eat the cookies straight out of the box. So we wondered, what else can you do with them? Well, luckily, the Girl Scouts have some suggestions. Do-si-do peanut Thai chicken, thank you berry munch bread pudding, and thin mint brownies, among others. Elizabeth Ferry is Community Relations Manager for the Girl Scout Council of Colonial Coast in Chesapeake, Virginia, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Now, I understand that you've tried some of these recipes.
Yes, I've tried Samoa trail mix. It's something you can kind of bring along anywhere you go, and it adds a little bit of sweetness when you throw those Samoas in there.
But you just chop them up and add that to peanuts and some M&Ms and things like that?
Exactly. So you can really make it your own, whatever you want to throw in there. But it's a great addition.
There's one in particular that I want to ask you about, the Do-si-do peanut Thai chicken. Because this is something I haven't thought about using cookies for savory dishes.
Oh, I love this one. This one, you know, it's really great as an appetizer. The peanut butter soy sauce mixture that you can make to dip into it really complements the crunchy Do-si-dos that you put on top. And it's amazing. You would never realize that there are cookies on your chicken when you're eating it. It's delicious.
Now, Elizabeth, I understand that you have also tried the recipe for fried shrimp made with Samoas. Those are the chocolate coconut cookies. Chocolate and shrimp.
Yes. It's a very light addition. I honestly don't think you necessarily notice the chocolate because you're going to add some extra coconut flakes in there anyway. So really, it tastes like coconut shrimp with an extra added sweetness. And it's kind of that little something that you're not quite sure what's in there, but you know it's good.
So how do you do this?
First, you want to kind of prepare the shrimp, you know, make sure that they're peeled and deveined and all of that. And then you're going to kind of make your own mixture. I actually put it in one of those big Ziploc bags, the coconut flakes, breadcrumbs, and really crushed up Samoa cookies. And then you go through the process of having your shrimp and putting them into the flour, throwing them into the egg whites, and then I put them directly in that bag to make the mixing kind of easier. And after that, it's just a matter of frying it in the oil.
Sounds interesting.
Yes, it really is tasty. You know, coconut shrimp is so popular, and why not add a cookie that is not only fantastic to the taste, but you know that by buying the box, you're really supporting a great cause.
Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Ferry. She's the Community Relations Manager for the Girl Scout Council of Colonial Coast in Chesapeake, Virginia. Our staff didn't want to just talk about these recipes. We wanted to try them. So in our impromptu test kitchen, we stirred up a batch of thin mint brownies and fried up some Samoa shrimp. And because I have a strong aversion to coconut, it's my own food rule, I've asked NPR science correspondent Joe Palca to come in and do some taste testing for us. Joe, you have a beautiful plate there in front of you.
Yes, I know.
Four delicious fried Samoa shrimp.
Work, work, work. But I'll try a bite just for you.
Crunchy.
Yeah, definitely crunchy. Don't get too much chocolate, but definitely crunchy, definitely fried, definitely shrimp. I'll give you all those.
Okay, definitely good?
Yeah.
Enthusiastic thumbs up?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think so.
Well, let's move on. I'm sorry to ask you to do this while you still have shrimp in your mouth, but time is tight. So let's try the thin mint brownie. Do you mind?
No, that goes great with shrimp. Hold on.
Actually, the mint is very nice.
Yeah, crunchy.
I'm grooving on this.
And minty.
This is making me happy.
Good.
If you want to try any of these in your own kitchen, you can find a link to these recipes and a few others, like Thank You Berry Munch Cranberry Pecan Chicken Salad. All that at NPR.org.
As any moviegoer knows, movies make magic. A spaceship lands. Humans become avatars. A man in a cape flies. This Sunday, some of today's magicians will get Academy Awards. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg concludes her annual series, Hollywood Jobs, with a few creators of special effects.
Megabuck millions or ultra-low budget, the goal is the same. Frighten, fool, or thrill your audience.
Oh my God.
Various special effects companies spent years making the magic for Avatar. At Legacy Effects in the San Fernando Valley, about 120 people helped create the look of an imaginary moon and its population. But in a cramped trailer in Van Nuys, only two guys are mixing up fake blood for a slasher scene.
You sneak through here?
The film is called Class, stands for Criminal Law and Student Slayings. It is so low budget, $1 million. They're shooting in producer Sheldon Robbins' aunt's house. Robbins puts much of his money on special effects makeup.
The most important part was making sure my kills didn't look cheesy.
Jerry Constantine will commit the makeup murders. He worked on the heavy-duty makeup film Benjamin Button. Usually, for bloody scenes, Jerry attaches plastic tubing to the actor's back and, with a syringe, fires fake blood through the tubing onto the screen. But not on this budget.
They don't have time for the two-hour makeup for me to pull the actor, glue the appliance on, and then squirt the blood, and so we fake it out.
Viewers will see the actor after the throat's been slit. Sorry, I know, breakfast time, but it's all make-believe, remember. Here's how it's done.
We're going to actually use this one because we're going to cut the heck out of it.
Jerry Constantine is snipping a super-thin piece of latex foam, trimming it to glue onto the actor's throat. Mike Miesemer is Jerry's assistant.
This piece is going to wrap all the way around.
Yeah, this is going to work out perfect, Jerry.
Of course.
There's a horizontal slit in the foam piece. Jerry and Mike hold the fake skin against the actor's throat. The men work in tandem, surgeons in reverse.
This is the clavicle?
Yeah.
Jerry powders the line where the foam meets skin. With a sponge dipped in makeup, he dabs various pinks onto the fake flesh, then sprays on some freckles.
In your head like that? Yeah.
That's just incredible. Yeah, I would swear that was her skin.
Okay, are we about ready, Mike? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Just tilt your head back a bit.
And now, the slashing. Before it gets too terrible, we are going to cut away, as it were, to some of the special effects folks who worked on Avatar. But we'll be back.
There's some pieces from Terminator Salvation, and this big guy over here is the Iron Monger from Iron Man.
John Rosengrant worked for the late special effects pioneer Stan Winston, Jurassic Park, Aliens, for 25 years. The craft goes on at Rosengrant's company, Legacy Effects, where a big workroom is lined with specialty props from major action thrillers. Some outfits look like Transformers on steroids, pieces created by dozens and dozens of artisans.
Sculptors, mold makers, painters, seamstress, wig makers. It takes a huge group of people to make this stuff live.
Movie magic.
People are amazed when they look at Iron Man. It looks like it's hard, shiny metal, but then if you touch the actual suit in places, it's actually rubber.
Their challenge was to make the heavy armor light. I don't understand why that was so hard. Centuries ago, knights wore shining armor and went to war. So if they could do it, why such a problem now?
Well, actors don't want to be wearing a 100-pound suit of armor, sweating. Maybe they're cut out of a different cloth than those knights of yore.
In Avatar, the bad guy climbs into what looks like a tank with legs.
That's the AMP suit, which is short for Armored Mobile Platform. Yeah. It's like an Apache helicopter meets the power loader from Aliens.
13 feet high and really menacing. On a more human scale, John Rosengrant and his team also created the prosthetic legs actor Sam Worthington wears before his character, Jake, leaves his wheelchair to become an avatar. They found a Sam-sized young man whose paralysis didn't stop him from playing basketball and made a cast of his legs.
Finished them off in silicone and punched individual hairs into them, and those would get strapped onto Sam, and his legs would go down through the wheelchair.
He was sitting in a special chair that had holes in the seat.
That's right. But I think it was important to make sure that this was convincing because it really sells the idea of Jake in his freedom as an avatar versus how he was trapped on Earth.
Yep. I have some if you don't.
Back in the makeup trailer for Criminal Law and Student Slayings, special effects artist Jerry Constantine is finishing his victim's look by creating what he delicately calls the meat. uglifying the wound he's made in the actor's throat.
I'm going to add a little bit of glue here, and then a little bit of cotton.
Jerry pushes a strip of cotton dabbed with red food coloring in along the slit line, and then, with a tiny spatula, he applies what looks like raspberry jelly on top of the cotton. And, ick, thickened blood.
This is the fun part.
Why is this fun?
Well, because this is where it starts to come together, and
I can't look at this anymore. I hate to tell you, Jerry.
Because it looks so real. The special makeup effects are done. It's time to shoot. Or slash.
And action rehearsal.
Mom. Tommy.
Cut. Can't let you hear anymore. We took a secrecy oath. We promised not to give away any clues that could spoil your terror.
68/69.
In California, where killers and their victims can have dinner together after a long day's work, and extraterrestrials go home and do laundry. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
I'm just imagining Susan with her right hand raised, taking that secrecy oath. Now, after you finished your breakfast, you can find a photo gallery of that gory neck gash and some specialty props from Avatar, Iron Man, and Terminator at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.